This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, Bridge senior writer Ron French explains why college costs are rising faster at some universities for low-income students. But first, a night out in the Kalamazoo area could mean the theater, a movie, perhaps a bite to eat, and you can certainly find a craft beer to wash down dinner if you want to. Whatever Kalamazoo may be lacking, it isn't breweries. Tiffany Fitzgerald, the staff writer for Encore magazine, her story in the January edition of Encore is called Beer, Beer Everywhere. Tiffany Fitzgerald, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, why did you want to take a look at the idea of craft beer in Kalamazoo? What did you find interesting about this?
I think I found the dialogue interesting that people were having about whether or not we could possibly sustain any more breweries. And my editor, Marie Lee, is the eternal cynicist, and she was sure that this just couldn't be. It was going to burst pretty soon. And I dove into it, and at a national level, there certainly is a worry about that. But then kind of talking to people in Kalamazoo, they're very optimistic about how much room there is. So that started really intriguing me, and I just kept interviewing more and more people.
So I think most people know that we have seen craft breweries just popping up in Kalamazoo. It seems like almost every week you hear of another one coming or find out that somebody else has a grand opening. Is that similar to what we find nationwide? Is it similar to what we find in cities the size of Kalamazoo?
Yeah, absolutely. There are other cities that are the size of Kalamazoo that have established this many breweries a long time ago in the late 90s or the early 2000s. But the amount of breweries we had last year were around 3,000, but the amount of permits for breweries was around 4,000. So nationwide, we're definitely braced for this type of growth that we've seen in Kalamazoo.
There are also different types of breweries, and you go into a fair amount of detail in the article explaining how this works, but try to give our listeners here maybe a thumbnail sketch. What are the different types of breweries that are out there? What sort of different things do they do?
Well, there's, according to the American Brewers Association, there's four different types of segments in the craft brewing market. There's a microbrewery that produces less than 15,000 barrels per year, but also has 70% of its sales in traditional beer sales, so at a retail site or off-site of the brewery. Then there's a brew pub that sells 25% or more of its beer on-site and also might offer food or restaurant services. We see a lot of those in Kalamazoo. And there's contract brewing companies that are contracted to brew beer for other restaurants or even another brewery, and that's their only business, is going business to business like that. And then there's regional craft breweries like Bell's or Arcadia that are larger than a microbrewery with how many barrels they output, but they still are localized in craft beer.
So you talked to quite a few of the brewers in this area. Did you get a sense that there's a different appeal based on the type of brewery that you've opened in terms of the clientele you're likely to bring in?
Yeah, I did get a sense of that. But I also, from talking to the brewers, they talked about new segments opening up in all of their markets. For instance, women, especially in Old Peninsula or Arcadia, who have been around a long time. Both of those owners talked about seeing a lot more women drinkers, also seeing drinkers who might traditionally have drank domestics like Miller or Coors, so baby boomers, coming into craft beer as well. But there are differences in the type of brewer, like a One Well brewery and a Rupert's brewery having kind of a younger, like kind of hipstery feel, and then Arcadia, which is really fresh and modern, and Bell's that has kind of this laid-back music vibe. So there's definitely a lot to offer.
So you mentioned that part of the reason you wanted to look into this was the question of, are we hitting some sort of saturation point in Kalamazoo? And you say that from everything you can tell, we're still a ways off from that. What are the indicators that say that we still have more room for growth in the brewery industry?
I think one of the biggest indicators that I didn't think about coming into the story, that Hannah McKinney, one of the sources in the story, and she's an economist professor at Kalamazoo College, she pointed out that a lot of these breweries don't fall into a microbrewery segment. They fall into the brew pub segment, which is a restaurant segment. And it's very popular to hear in the restaurant industry that there's always room for more. But it's always with the caveat, there's always room for good restaurants. And that's kind of what I heard from everybody about breweries and brew pubs as well. If you're producing great beer and if you're producing great food, then there's enough room in the market for you.
Early in your story, you pulled a quote that was actually in Draft Magazine from the CEO of Founders Brewing, Mike Stevens, said, "I wouldn't want to be a startup brewery right now. The days when you could open a brewery and really try to learn your path are over. You need a good plan from the get-go." And as you said, some people read that and interpreted that as we were hitting some sort of peak in terms of craft brewing, whether or not that was the intention or not. Is that the way some people have read it? And is that the way that, I guess, brewers responded to it?
Yeah, definitely. And all of the outlets that I've read that had quoted that quote from Draft Magazine, which Bon Appetit was one of, and MLive as well, the basic overall tone is this type of growth, this type of fast growth, definitely can't last forever. And Mike Stevens also went on to say in the same article that he predicted a bubble burst in the next 5 years. That was 2013. But he also says that if it's great beer, it'll have a place. So I don't think that that's unrealistic to think that just like restaurants or any other industry, anything bad's going to get pushed out. And it is a more competitive market now than it was when Mike Stevens started. I think he has a point that if you are starting right now, you really do have to have a pretty solid plan in place.
And that's another way that quote could certainly be read, is that the market is more competitive now, and that when you start, you better be able to hit the ground running because you have so many other breweries, so many other options that people have. Is that perhaps more of what he was getting at?
I think so. I think he's talking to two different things. One is definitely that you have to come into this with a good plan and good beer. And another is that the kind of rocket ship pace at which we're growing nationally as a craft beer industry just might not be sustainable for much longer. And that's a pretty popular viewpoint nationally.
One of the things you mentioned in this story is that the one-year mark is very important, really for any restaurant to kind of know if they're really going to make it or not. That being the case, are there some brew pubs out there that we still don't know yet if they're going to hit that one-year mark and be able to sustain beyond that?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, we're just watching the brew pubs. We just saw the brew pubs in 2013 hit their 2014 one-year mark. There were brew pubs that opened in 2014, even at the very end of it, like One Well in November, I think. So we're not going to know how successful those breweries and brew pubs are for a little while.
Some people, I'm sure, think, well, there's all these breweries, there's only so many people to drink beer.
Mm-hmm.
But there's an interesting quote you have from Chris O'Neill, who along with TJ Waldowski opened up One Well Brewing over on Portage Street in November. And he made the comment that he doesn't think anyone is really stepping on anyone's toes. That in other words, there's sort of this mass, I guess you could say, bringing in synergy, I guess, amongst all the brewers. Is that how more of them see it?
That's how a lot of them see it, yeah. And I feel like that structure, we see that in Grand Rapids as well. You have your anchor brewery. So we have Bell's, we have Arcadia now too, and Old Peninsula. And then you see these little breweries pop up all over the place. But where One Well is down on Portage Road, there's really no breweries down there. And so what he's talking about is this sort of spreading out and this room to grow in this way that they're all doing something different within their brewery, but they're also in a different location. And we heard that from the sources at Southwest Michigan First as well.
And do the people at Southwest Michigan First think that perhaps this is something that makes Kalamazoo a place to visit?
Oh, yeah, they're very excited about it. And they had talked about also talking with Discover Kalamazoo. This type of people love to go to new breweries. This culture around breweries that they like to hop. Even in one night, people like to go to more than one brewery sometimes. But try one out every week, figure out what type of personality a brewery has. Maybe you have a favorite, but the culture is definitely going from one to another. And because we're so close to Grand Rapids, and because we're now offering all of these different breweries, we've become a pretty hot tourist spot. We already were a tourist spot for Bell's, but now instead of making a night of it at Bell's, you can stay a weekend and really get to enjoy a lot of different beers.
And there are quite a few of these breweries downtown. Do they enjoy perhaps an advantage in that sense that people can go to several of these places and they don't have to get in their car and worry about getting behind the wheel after having enjoyed a few beers for the evening?
Yeah, I think that's a huge appeal. And that'll be that is one area we do have room for growth because we're such an expansive county. Then we have a brewery coming up at Texas Corners. Well, we can definitely see that growth more there because people don't want to drive from Texas Corners to downtown to Portage for exactly that reason. They really want to stay. And there are hosted brewery tours in downtown Kalamazoo, and they definitely, local businesses, restaurants, and hotels profit off of that as well.
And of course, there is, as you just noted there is a fair amount of growth outside of downtown Kalamazoo, Portage, Texas Corners. So the idea of breweries seems to have a foothold throughout Kalamazoo County in some ways.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that there's a lot of excitement about what's happening downtown. And even though not everybody wants to jump into the downtown scene, there's going to be a lot of room for growth in the outlying parts of Kalamazoo County as well.
Your story begins by noting that it was a snowy night in November, and you apparently headed out to try a couple places yourself. And the observation you made is that, yes, it was snowing. It was perhaps a night when many people might, you think, prefer to be home. And yet you found a lot of activity out there on the streets of Kalamazoo and in these various brew pubs. Does that perhaps tell us that, yes, the economists and others are right, more growth is available?
It seems to indicate that on as much a level as it can. It was definitely interesting because the first snow of the year, most people don't go out on that Thursday night. But yeah, it's really interesting to me. And when I go by on the weekends, which I did several times during the research for this story, places were just packed. Like Old Peninsula would be wall to wall. And I just think that there is definitely a culture here in Kalamazoo and in Michigan that is a beer culture. And so this is a really good area to have a lot of breweries then.
Did the people you talked to give you a sense that there is something particular about Kalamazoo that allows this sort of growth that maybe it wouldn't work in another city in Michigan or another city in the Midwest?
Yes, I think that one thing that a lot of people pointed to was Bell's. Bell's is a really big reason there can be all these little breweries. And the owners of One Well pointed that out as well, that you need that kind of cornerstone brewery, that big name brewery. And another reason is we're a college town. We have Kalamazoo College and WMU. And we also have a very big art scene. We have a big music scene, writing scene, theater scene. Those are really the type of people who like to go out and enjoy themselves at night. They're not sort of homebodies. They like to be out in the town and experience different types of cultures.
What do people say about the economic impact of breweries in Kalamazoo?
It's kind of hard to tell what the economic impact of breweries in Kalamazoo is going to be yet, because so many of them started in 2013 and 14 that it's going to take a little bit more time to see the long-term effect of it. But if it's anything like the effect it's had on Michigan or the effect it's had on the nation, it's going to have a very positive effect on wages, job growth, and keeping money in a local market, which is always really important for economists and local economy.
Tiffany Fitzgerald, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Cheers.
All right.
Tiffany Fitzgerald is staff writer for Encore Magazine. She's also editor of its sister publication, FYI. Her story, Beer, Beer Everywhere, can be found at EncoreKalamazoo.com and through a link at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Rising college costs and increasing student loan debt are problems for students from many backgrounds. But Bridge, the online news service of the Center for Michigan, finds that students from low-income families are bearing more of the brunt of the higher price tag for higher education. Ron French is senior writer for Bridge. Ron French, thank you for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
Explain how you found that low-income students at some universities in Michigan are seeing their costs go up more than their counterparts from wealthier families.
Sure. The gist of this is that if you don't have a kid in college, people would assume that if you go to college, it's the same price for everyone, right? Just like going out and buying a car. But it's more like buying an airline ticket where everyone on board, it seems like, has paid a different price. That's a little bit what it's like with universities, because some kids get merit aid, some students get financial aid depending on their family incomes. So the federal government requires universities to report the net cost, and that's how much you're supposed to pay for tuition and books and fees and housing, minus all your grants and scholarships. Universities are required to provide that net cost to the federal government along with the family's income. Okay. So what the federal government then releases is the net cost by income bracket for each university. Well, that's very good information for parents to look at, because they get a sense of how much universities pay. But to answer your question directly about how we found this out, is then you can look at trend lines over a period of years. And we found something very surprising, that even at this time when there's so much attention being paid to college costs and so much attention being paid to we have to get more kids up from lower income brackets into college, at some universities, the net cost has actually gone up faster for the poorest kids than for the richest kids.
Would the big broad brush takeaway here be that means that there is less need-based aid out there, and perhaps maybe the same amount of merit-based aid for a student who's high achieving, but not as much aid for the student who comes from a poorer background?
It was sort of a perfect storm for a lot of these public universities in the state. At the same period of time, and this was a period from 2008, 2009 to 2012-13 school year. So you think about what was happening back in 2008, 2009. The economy was in a nosedive, particularly here in Michigan. And two things happened at that point. That's also the same period in which the state budget was falling apart. And so some of the state financial aid that was available to students disappeared. You probably remember, some of your listeners may remember, the Promise Grant that a lot of students got. Well, that disappeared. At the same time, a lot of families saw their incomes going down, and so they were lower income than they used to be and needed more financial aid. So if you're a Western Michigan, you look at a situation where you lost millions and millions of dollars in state aid that might have otherwise gone in past years to help poorer students afford college. At the same time, they're getting more low-income students apply to Western Michigan. And so you have a smaller pie and more people wanting a piece of it. And so what happened at Western and at some other universities is they really had very little choice, but the financial aid for some of those students is lower than they would have liked it to have been.
Western Michigan University is one of the schools where you found that students from lower income families are, in fact, paying more. So what do people at Western say that they are doing to try and address that discrepancy?
They realize it's happening. They're unhappy about it. And next fall, in fact, they are beefing up their scholarships for low-income students. They're going to start with $50,000. That's going to be split between, I think, 10 low-income students, low-income, high-achieving freshmen, and they're going to be expanding it after that. You know, and that's great for that number of students. It's a great start, but let's face it, it's a drop in the bucket for what's needed. Western and almost all universities in the state say the real answer to this is for the state government to reinvest in student financial aid. Here's something that our listeners may think about, chew on a little bit, is that Michigan ranks 41st in the nation per capita in how much we provide for student financial aid. And, you know, when you're ranked 41st in the amount of aid you're giving, it's going to have implications.
There are, of course, other universities are facing some of the same problems. Are other schools finding other ways to address this, taking different approaches?
There absolutely are. First, you need to not even consider the University of Michigan in this sort of discussion, because the University of Michigan has such a large endowment that they are able to provide more aid. At the University of Michigan, during the same time period that Western Michigan saw, Western Michigan increased its net cost for its poorest students by 27%. The University of Michigan dropped by 10% for those the cost for poor students. But you can't really consider University of Michigan because of the size of their endowment. So what about the other universities that are comparable to a Western? For example, Oakland University. 4 or 5 years ago, Oakland University was the most expensive public university in the state for poor students to attend. But now it's one of the cheapest. They intentionally took money away from wealthier classmates and shoved it into financial aid for the lowest income, which is, we're defining low income as from students from families making $30,000 or less in a year. So Oakland was able to find a way to do it. It's not they found a big barrel of money buried in the backyard. It's they made a conscious decision. We have to provide more aid to the low income. This is a moral imperative.
You mentioned earlier that it's really not the right way to look at this to even include the University of Michigan in the discussion. Are various universities here perhaps playing the game just very differently and maybe not out of choice, but just because they don't have the same resources, the same endowment that some of the larger schools have?
Sure. And there's always a balancing act at universities that do not have the resources of the University of Michigan, which is almost every university in the nation. But when you look at a Western, when you look at a Grand Valley, you have to look at how are we able to split this money, this bucket of money we have for financial aid. We can just pour it all into the lowest income students. But almost all universities also want to attract as many high-achieving students as possible. And how you do that is you provide merit aid. And merit aid is money that is provided in scholarships for high-achieving high school students. If I have an ACT score of 32, and I'm applying to Western, I'm applying to Eastern and Central, if I were the parent of that kid, I'd be looking at, okay, I'm in all these schools. Who's giving me the best financial package? If one of those schools says, you know, your student did really well in high school, we really want them here, we're going to give them $5,000 in merit aid, that would have otherwise, Gordon, maybe you could have decided to give that to the low-income students. But that's sort of, it's just like shopping for a car. You know, if I feel I can get the same education several places, you go where you can get the best deal. And experts in academia say that it's really important for everyone at university to have a great diversity at your school. And I don't just mean racial diversity or geographic diversity. It's academic achievement diversity. It's important for there to be very high achieving students at these schools, to be in your classes right next to another student. And how you sometimes have to attract those is providing little merit aid. So what I'm saying is that at a Western or a Grand Valley or wherever, these universities have to still provide some merit aid to attract some of the other students.
You mentioned that idea of the parent looking at the various schools and where their child may choose to go and considering the cost that is associated. But another story that you have on the Bridge site also warns people that they need to look beyond the sticker price. Explain a little bit about what that means.
Oh, absolutely. And we have a cost calculator on our site, www.bridgemi.com. It's a college cost calculator where you can type in your income bracket, and all 15 public universities in the state will come up and show you what the average net price would be. Net price varies wildly from the sticker price. Unless you're making, I'm going to throw out a figure, probably $150,000, $200,000 a year, sticker prices don't mean much, okay, because everyone pays less than that. So what you have to do is look at the sticker prices and apply anyway. A lot of poor students sometimes do not apply to a University of Michigan or a Michigan State thinking that they aren't going to be able to afford it. But actually, those two universities are among the cheapest for students who are low income. Let me give you an example. University of Michigan, highest sticker price in the state, but it's the cheapest university to attend if your family makes under $30,000 a year. And frankly, Western Michigan is one of the most expensive for at the moment for those who don't make much money. So you have to not look at the sticker price. Every university, if you don't use our cost calculator, every university has on their website, they're required now, you can go there and put net cost calculator in there, and you type in a little information about your finances, it will give you an estimate of how much it would cost to actually attend there. That's very important because As I said, you may find college a lot more affordable than you think.
Some of the people you talked to brought up the concerns they have that there are broader implications for Michigan's economy and Michigan's future wrapped up in this issue. Specifically, what are those concerns?
Michigan is below the national average in percent of its population with a college degree. Why is that important? Because the higher the percentage of your population with a college degree, the better the economics of your state, that they run parallel to each other. So there's a big push, and the governor is very much behind this. We have to find a way to increase the number of people who earn college degrees. It's one thing getting them into college and another thing to for them to stay there long enough to get a degree. So how do you do that? Well, middle-class families whose parents went to college, most of their kids are already going to college. Who's not going to college? If we're going to increase our percentage of adults with degrees, we have to get more kids into college whose parents did not go. Well, a fair share of those families are low to moderate income. So college is a big financial burden for them. When we are placing a larger burden, at least as far as the college cost increase, we're putting more of the increase on low-income families, we're decreasing the chances these kids are going to graduate. They may get into school, but a lot of them drop out because they can't afford it. So the key is, shouldn't we as a state look at this and say, this is an economic good for the state to try to get these kids from low and moderate income families into college and make sure it's affordable enough for them so they can graduate? It helps them, sure. You can look at it as a moral good, but it's an economic good for the state as more of these kids end up with degrees and go out and work in white-collar jobs and are engineers and scientists, you know, and teachers that make a decent living. That helps everybody.
So what are some possible solutions out there? You mentioned earlier what some of the schools are doing. I'm wondering if there are other proposals and if there's anybody out there who's pushing for more policy changes at the state level to address the problem.
There's a lot of talk out there, and some states are trying different things. There are states that are experimenting with free public university. There are states that are looking at sort of pay it forward type of thing where your loans are forgiven if you stay in the state a certain amount of time. There are states that are considering programs where that you attend for free, but then you promise to pay a certain percentage of your income over the period of years after you graduate back to the state. And so hopefully the state is paid back for their investment in the student. There are all sorts of things that states are looking at. From a university point of view, you know, there's always, they have to look at how their balances, their budgets are put together. Is there a way to put more money into student financial aid, particularly for the low-income students? And from an individual point of view, you need to shop around. It's just like buying a car. It's just like buying a washer or a dryer, for that matter. You don't just go into one store, look at one model, and buy it. You look at the variety, you look at the quality, and how much the cost is, because there's a vast variance in how much some of these universities will end up costing your child to get a degree in 4 years. And the other thing that families can do to try to limit cost, help encourage your student to graduate in 4 years instead of five or five and a half. The average now is about 5 years to get a bachelor's degree. Think about that, how much more that costs. That's another full year of school. So the more that we can do to help kids get into school, get them out on time, the better off everyone's going to be.
Ron French, as always, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Ron French is senior writer for Bridge, the online news service of the Center for Michigan. The stories on low-income students bearing more of the increasing cost of higher education can be found at bridgemi.com and through a link at our website, wmuk.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.